Good evening. Thank you for coming tonight despite the weather. My name is Bryce Stevenson, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, American Oracle, the Memory of the Civil War. Tonight's program is in recognition of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and the launch of the House Divided Project's website. It has been made possible with the support of the House Divided Project, Dickinson College's Department of History, and the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. Tonight, it is my privilege to introduce Professor Matthew Pinsker, Associate Professor, Chair of the History Department, holder of the Brian C. Pohanka 77 Faculty Chair in American Civil War History at Dickinson College, and a co-director of the House Divided Project. Professor Pinsker teaches courses in U.S. political, legal, and diplomatic history. His research focuses on the career of Abraham Lincoln, partisanship in the Civil War era, American constitutionalism, the Underground Railroad, and the history of U.S. campaigns and elections. Professor Pinsker is the author of Abraham Lincoln, published by Congressional Quarterly Press in 2002, and Lincoln's Sanctuary, Abraham Lincoln and the Soldier's Home, published by Oxford University Press in 2003. Before we begin, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, there will be a question and answer session at the end of the program, so please hold all questions until that time. Following the program, there will be a book signing in the lobby. Thank you, and now please join me in welcoming Professor Matthew Pinsker.
So thank you so much for coming, especially with this weather, but it's an important occasion. This weekend, we are beginning the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And it's a time for us to reflect on the history of the conflict and also its meaning for the present. And I think tonight's lecture is going to give us just a marvelous window into how Americans have actually struggled with that process over the years. It's not nearly as easy as it might seem on the surface. Although I have a number of students here, and I think they know, history is never easy. It's always a complicated mix, and I hope David Blight will do a wonderful job in helping us navigate some of that tonight. But before I introduce David Blight, there is something else I wanted to discuss. As part of the anniversary of the Civil War, we have been building a project here at Dickinson, which you see on the screen behind me. The House Divided Project is a five-year-long effort so far, and we expect to be working on it through the end of the anniversary. The project's longer than the war, but we're determined to finish by 2015. And it's a project aimed at helping K-12 and undergraduate classroom teachers find more exciting ways to teach this important era. So exciting today means digital. And we have been working very hard to create interesting digital tools that will help teachers do a better job and help students get more engaged. So this weekend we had a series of events. David's lecture tonight is the capstone of this series. We had a film festival at the Carlisle Theater yesterday it was a wonderful experience. We had over 300 people. The theater was packed from the community. Several of you were there. We have a number of people coming to see student-produced documentary films, videos using documents, census records, letters, diaries, and other materials that we've collected as part of our project that they've used to tell the stories of ordinary families from Carlisle and ordinary individuals who struggled during the Civil War era to reconcile their private and public responsibilities. This morning we had a teacher workshop. We have a group of very hardy teachers from Utah here. I'm so grateful that you came to join us. Thank you so much. And we have other teachers from the community and from across the region, so thank you all for coming. We had a really good session this morning. And then in the afternoon, we did, despite the weather, I know this is going to sound almost insane, but we did augmented reality tours. We didn't actually do much walking, but we tried to feature this new technology that we use, which is going to be, in a sense, I think, the next wave of historical or heritage tourism. We use smartphones or tablet computers like the iPad, which have GPS and cameras and the ability to draw data from the internet to create a kind of immersive walking tour experience. It allows you to draw video, text, image. You could hear David Blight's voice talk about Frederick Douglass as you visit the site where Douglass came to Carlisle in 1872. when he gave a speech in town. This is after the war, but nonetheless, the war still was unfinished in some sense. Carlisle was a northern town, but it still segregated black citizens. Douglas wasn't allowed to eat in the dining room of the hotel because he was black and there were white guests. So it's a complicated story that doesn't end with the war itself in 1865. But with the technology now, we can do an awful lot to make it engaging for the students. And so we've created an augmented reality tour in Carlisle, and we showed it at the old courthouse, which was an important venue for the Underground Railroad. And then tonight we have this lecture. And in front of you, you have a sample of our database. I'm going to take a few more minutes and just show you what we've been trying to do lately. This is the research engine that we offer students and teachers. We call this a research engine because we want people to see the difference between search and research. We want people to realize that searching on the internet yields hits, but research is what builds connections. It's a very important teaching opportunity. And so when you enter our database, you go back 150 years ago to that day, and you see the stories of people who were born or who were celebrating birthdays on that day. In this case, you see a series of events, like the Virginia Secession Convention meeting, or the governor of Kentucky denouncing the onset of the war, or, in this case, a series of letters and articles and newspaper stories. Here we have a letter to Abraham Lincoln. If we try to find connections, we can find out background on the major topic. The beautiful thing about technology is sometimes it's slow, but it usually always works. In this case, you see we have a series of tabs and records on a topic like secession. We have note cards or clippings from textbooks and secondary sources, kind of like the old 3x5 cards that all of us used at some point in our lives. We have events. Here you're looking at a list of events related to secession. All of these events are clickable and dig deeper and deeper into records, and from those records you can dig deeper and deeper into other records. This is an awfully large project. It features people, it features documents, it features places, images. In some ways, this is the most extraordinary thing of all. We have 10,000 public domain images in this database that are free for teachers to use. That's largely the work, by the way, that's not largely my work. That's largely the work of John Osborne, the co-director of this project, who's now retired because of this, right? this beat him into emeritus status, 10,000 public domain images. But it's an extraordinary resource for public school teachers and all teachers. We, you know, have created a massive constructed project. Its scope is large and it's unfinished, but it can be intimidating. And so with another minute, I wanted to show you how we're trying to use digital tools to make this less imposing. So we created a website with the Journal of American History. This was actually built by students. Some of them are in this room. And their names are featured here. But what we did for the Journal of American History was try to show academics how digital tools can help expand their research and improve their teaching. So we have, for example, word clouds, like this one, of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, the 100 most frequently repeated words in the 7 Lincoln-Douglas debates. It's a graphic representation of word frequency. But if you want to see what they were saying when they mentioned those words, you can now see them in context. So this is the word Negro as they talked about it in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And if you want to go to the full text of the debates, you can just click right there. So you see what the digital world does. It doesn't replace paper. We love paper. It adds another layer. We have now a visual representation of the debates. We have excerpts that might be used in the classroom, and then we have the full text that can be read on your own. That's how you can teach, by layering the information. We can do one other thing, which is we can change the way people see data, because sometimes it's hard for people to imagine how data works. And so this is something called a hypergraph. What you're looking at is the research engine. This is what it looks like if you would graph it. So sometimes people look at a query bar or a search engine, they can't even fathom what lies behind it or how to use it. This shows the House Divided Research Engine as a graph. Now the thing is, this is live. So if you click on these topics, you go into the record in the research engine, which, again, is another way to reach people who learn in different fashions. So I don't want to take up any more of your time tonight, but outside at the end of the night, we have all kinds of material on our project. If you're interested in this or want to help participate in it, a project like this depends on contributions from people who use it. So we would be eager to have them. But with that said, I now want to turn it over to somebody who can provide us with some content and context at this moment. David Blight is a renowned professor at Yale University. He's one of the leading historians of the Civil War and its memory in American life. He's the author of a number of very important books, a book on Frederick Douglass's intellectual life, a very notable book called Race and Reunion that changed the way people talked about the process of memory in American life. It was a prize-winning book, the Bancroft Prize, the Lincoln Prize, a number of other awards. He wrote a book called A Slave No More, and he's just now publishing a book about the memory of the Civil War itself called American Oracle. This is the book that's going to form the starting point of his discussion for us tonight. David is also a great teacher. You know, we say that about everybody who comes here, but this is true. And I can prove it. And this is another reason why I am so glad to have him here, because he understands, I think, and appreciates what we're trying to do. David's Civil War class is online. If you want to take it, it's available to you. The videotapes of his entire course, Yale University has posted online at their open course program. You can take David Blight's Civil War class. And I can tell you, it demonstrates both the highs and the lows of the learning experience. I love watching him lecture because I can learn things from it, and I love watching him yell at the occasional student who's reading a newspaper in class and captured on video and broadcast to the world, right? It makes it so human, but it's so real. So with that said, I'd like to bring David Blight to the podium to offer us a discussion tonight of the American Oracle, the memory of the Civil War.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Well, thanks, Matt. I'd forgotten about that episode in my class. The truth is, back, way in the back, a kid one morning was reading the Yale Daily News, just relaxing, and I was lecturing on the Dred Scott case that day, and the reason I remember that is because I stopped and I said, "The Dred Scott case is not covered in the Yale Daily News today," and he didn't hear me. He's still reading, so I screamed it. The rest of the class is falling on the floor. "The Dred Scott case is not covered in..." Kid crunched up his paper and he went out the back door and I never saw him again. I felt bad about that for a minute. Matt, thank you. You sure we can't just keep doing this? This was cool. I feel like I'm intruding here on all your fun tonight. It's a wonderful opportunity to come here. I've been to Carlisle before, but only to use the Army War College a couple of times for research. I think I've been through Carlisle on the way to Gettysburg a few times. And President Durden, thank you for dinner beforehand and all the conversation. Professor Osborne, all of your work on this has already been recognized. And Matt, I love your book on Lincoln. And that's where I learned that Frederick Douglass turned down an invitation to tea at the soldier's home, which he later regretted after Lincoln died. I am here to try to talk about where we're at in this country with this problem of remembering our Civil War. We're obviously now at the beginning of the sesquicentennial. I've had a few days of late when I wished it was kind of over, only because every media outlet in the land seems to have assigned somebody in the last 3 weeks to write something about this or do some talk show, which is great. I mean, it's important that we have this opportunity. It's just always interesting to encounter journalistic ignorance. of the most important parts of our history. However, I will say I've been very impressed with some, namely the guy David von Drehle, who wrote the cover story for Time magazine, among others. The BBC, by the way, is doing an extraordinary set of programming about us, about our civil. They're doing a three-hour documentary, radio documentary, about our Civil War. I don't know who in the United States, frankly, is doing a three-hour documentary about our Civil War. But I really want to do, what I really want to do tonight is ask a couple of big questions with you out loud, suggest some possible answers, but hopefully leave you thinking about yet more of your own. What is it that makes this story endure? Why doesn't the Civil War just go away? Why doesn't the Confederacy just go away? Why can't we forget it, get over it, get beyond it? I did a lengthy interview with a Spanish newspaper, I don't know, a week ago or so, and the reporter was actually very good. He had covered a great deal of this story within Spain, as some of you may know, of how they are remembering in their national culture the age of Franco, the fascist period in Spain, and then the Spanish Civil War. That's only been 60 years for them. 60 or 70. And his first question, of course, was, I understand why we're not over ours after 60 years, but 150? You know, what's the problem in America? And in the BBC, the reporter got me talking, we had the English Civil War, you know, in the 17th century, but we don't commemorate that much. Why do you just, you reenact your Civil War, you commemorate it all the time, you can't get over it? I said, well, it may have something to do with the fact you killed your king at the beginning of it. Maybe that's the problem. I don't know. You know, and that Cromwell burned all those abbeys, and maybe, I don't know. You know, I said, I can't help you on that one. Sorry. Why don't we get over it? I want to begin by taking us to a particular historical moment. And you all know it. It may be one of those iconic moments, very few left perhaps, that every American has some kind of image of, I suspect, even the youngest of us. A breeze eased the intense heat of the late August afternoon as the huge crowd, weary but peaceful and jubilant, leaned forward to listen. All along the reflecting pool of the Washington, D.C. Mall, people steadied their sore feet and peered up at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the official secular temple of the United States. Martin Luther King Jr., a young Southern Baptist minister who had become the preeminent face and voice of the civil rights movement, stepped to the microphones and delivered a short, transcendent oration to the world on the meaning of the unfinished American Civil War, and thereby the meaning of America. On August 28, 1963, King gave what should be considered and should be remembered as the most important Civil War centennial speech of that turbulent and very divisive commemoration at the 100th anniversary. As American society engages now the sesquicentennial, King's famous address demands a hearing, or better, a reading. Google it on YouTube. Two clicks get you there. If you haven't recently, do so. And what will always be known as the I Have a Dream speech, the dream metaphor, as I'm sure many of you know, emerges very late in the speech and extemporaneously. He broke from text to do the dream business. In the second sentence after he simply said, I'm glad to be here, King announced the text of his sermon. He suggested the historical weight of the moment, and he began to employ other and equally unforgettable metaphors. I'll just quote briefly. 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a beacon of light, of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to the end of a long night of their captivity. 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. 100 years later, The life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives in an island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. No one who listens to that, no one who heard it then, no one who Googles it today, no one who reads it today can miss what he's doing. 50, he said. That's obviously a reference to Lincoln. In fact, I wanted to call my new book 50, but my publisher justifiably told me that nobody knows what that word means. So that's not the title. King then, of course, went on to yet more metaphors. The promissory note, he said, that came back labeled insufficient funds in the, quote, Bank of American Justice. That's a speech about the 100th anniversary of the Civil War and Emancipation. It's 1963. Every kid in America grows up today somehow hearing or maybe even memorizing at some moment in the fifth grade the dream paragraph at the end. It's all about a dreamer. That speech was a message to the United States that 100 years after emancipation, it hadn't worked. As Lincoln implied in that brief address at Gettysburg in November 1863, the Civil War, the outcome of which was still far from determined at his moment, necessitated a new founding, a redefinition of the United States, rooted somehow in the destruction of slavery and the reborn, ill-defined, vexing, and troubled principle of human equality. In the dream speech, King argued exactly the same thing for his own era. The Civil Rights Revolution heralded yet another refounding in the same principle, 100 anguished years after Lincoln's promise to do it better than the founders. The Civil War and civil rights have been forever intertwined in American history and in our deepest mythology. But in the period of the centennial, from the 1950s through into the mid-1960s, those two phenomena of the Civil War commemoration and civil rights movement were often like planets in separate orbits around separate suns. They could never quite occupy the same space. For 17 magnificent minutes, the power of King's rhetoric broke down the segregated gravitational pulls of those two planets and, for the moment, brought them into the same orbit. But befitting his role as the leader of a radical, if nonviolent, protest movement, King's arguments were hardly mainstream in Cold War American political culture of 1963. Who will deliver our great sesquicentennial speech? Or who will deliver our great sesquicentennial exhibition? Who will put down on paper our great sesquicentennial statement? I don't know. I mean, we're all waiting. We're yet to find out. What will be the argument of our moment at commemorating this event, which is an event, of course, that's much, much more than just the war that was fought. Now, this talk is called American Oracle, and of course I'm going to tell you where that came from. I've become a great fan of Robert Penn Warren's. For many years I have been, actually, but especially now after studying him in some depth. The new book that's about to come out in August, it's called American Oracle, The Civil War and the Civil Rights Era, focuses on four American writers, Robert Penn Warren, Bruce Catton, Edmund Wilson, and James Baldwin, with a serious nod and epilogue to Ralph Ellison. These were writers who had very deep and lasting, enduring, and authentically tragic things to say about the meaning and memory of our Civil War at its centennial. And I think they make a marvelous window through which, lens through which to try to peer into our own moment at the 150th and see just where we are. Red Warren wrote a great little book called The Legacy of the Civil War, published in 1961. It wasn't his only contribution to the Civil War centennial by any means, but it stands up. Perhaps some of you have actually taught it. It is still back in print, I think by the University of Nebraska Press. It's a meditation, really. It's a long essay. In fact, he first wrote it for Life magazine. Jerry Korn, who then was the editor of Life, put him up to it. And there's wonderful correspondence between them. And in one of those letters at one point, Korn writes to Warren, says, "Red, what you really have to do in this book now, or this long essay, is you have to explain this appeal of the Civil War. What's it all about, Red? What are the attractions," he said in this letter. "Why are we so attracted to this event? What is it? All these people want to reenact it, even then, 50 years ago. Red, you got to explain that." And Warren writes back, says, "Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to explain the attractions and so on." And then he writes in a wonderfully homespun, Red Warren-esque metaphor. He says, "Well, I suppose it's because we think that war made us so great in the end that we're a little bit like the dog staring at the icebox. We just can't stop looking at it. The dog staring at the icebox." Is that what we do sometimes? Is the Civil War sort of a huge train wreck or car accident we can't take our eyes off? Is it that big, terrible moment of horror that got photographed? So incredibly photographed? At another place in Legacy of the Civil War, Warren writes, he says, that the Civil War, quote, "draws us as an oracle, darkly unriddled and portentous, of personal as well as national fate." That's a mouthful, but it's a fascinating line. Our oracle. I made the mistake in a lecture recently of saying the Greeks had their oracle at Corinth, and somebody came up afterward and said, "Professor, Delphi. Delphi. Oracle at Delphi." And that got on video too, so I'm scared. It's frightening today with all these things being videotaped all over the place, and they're all on YouTube, and you know, you make an error out there and you get 15 emails telling you you're stupid. But is the Civil War our oracle? If so, where is it? Is the oracle on Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg? Is that where you go to find the source of wisdom from this event, the source of knowledge? For many, it probably is. I grew up going to Gettysburg. I used to bring high school groups from Flint, Michigan, kids who'd never been out, not only out of their state, never been out of their city. They'd never seen a hill higher than the pitching mound out behind their school. I used to bring 50 kids a spring out here, out east, as we said, and took them there. I used to read poetry with them out on Cemetery Ridge. I guess because it was supposed to be the place where they would learn some wisdom from the event. Or is the oracle on Monument Avenue in Richmond? Depends on who you ask. Is that where you go? That's where Douglas Southall Freeman went every day. Douglas Southall Freeman, the great biography of Robert E. Lee, what, 3 volumes and then 4 volumes of Lee's Lieutenants? Freeman lived right up Monument Avenue, and we're told he walked to work every day right by the Lee statue, the great equestrian. He would stop every day and salute Lee. That's where his oracle was. There's the oracle at Stone Mountain, which King, of course, ironically used in the I Have a Dream speech. Where's the oracle at Shaw Memorial in Boston? Augustus St. Gaudens' absolute masterpiece of sculpture. It's his greatest public sculpture he ever did, the famous monument to the 54th Massachusetts and its commander, Robert Gould Shaw. It happens to be my personal favorite Civil War monument. Is that where the oracle is? There's a story in that monument that is certainly oracular. Or is it somewhere else? Is our Civil War oracle the Lincoln Memorial? Is it there on the walls in those words in the Lincoln Memorial? Is that where you go to find our Civil War oracle? Have you ever been there alone? One time, I got up into Lincoln, late at night. I went for a run on the mall. once got up in, there were probably a few people hanging around. I remember being in there alone. Usually you go in there, there are 300 bodies there, and half of them are seventh graders squealing, and you just want them all to just go away, I'm reading. Or is the oracle in a favorite poem by Whitman? Or by Herman Melville? Or by Alan Tate? Or by Robert Penn Warren? Or by Langston Hughes? I don't know. Is your Civil War oracle in a favorite passage from a Bruce Catton book? All right, how many of you of a certain age grew up reading Bruce Catton? Not bad. Ooh, that's great, though. That means I might have something you can learn tonight. I don't know. Or is the Oracle now Ken Burns' film series? It's become an iconic, almost oracular phenomenon, that film series. They're rerunning it again, or they reran it last week, I think, on PBS. I was just on a panel in New York for the New York Times with Ken Burns, and my God, what a romantic he is. I mean, he's a beautiful storyteller. I mean, he's a great filmmaker. I mean, he just mesmerizes people with this kind of poetic vision of our Civil War. And you can't help it when you're there as a historian on a panel with Ken Burns. You feel like, all right, now I guess I'm going to have to be the skeptical historian and rein him in a little bit, throw a little reality on his, a little wet reality on his, parade. I didn't really mean to, but. But maybe Ken's film series really is our oracle. I don't know where the oracle is. You can decide. It was also Penn Warren in the same little book who said the Civil War is our felt history. The history lived in our national imagination, our felt history. Now, you can make that case for a few other parts of our history, too. There are a lot of other histories that are felt. But this one has a lasting feel, doesn't it? For a moment, Warren himself. Now, it's not the case anymore that anyone can grow up like Robert Penn Warren did learning his Civil War, or Bruce Catton did learning his. Or for that matter, Edmund Wilson did, learning his from his father, who was a Lincoln fanatic, and kept giving the young Edmund Wilson, who would later become this genius of a literary critic, book after book on Abraham Lincoln, and as Edmund Wilson told the story, he never read any of them because they were from his father. He was not going to be his father, that hard-driving lawyer, attorney general of New Jersey, who was this sort of straight-laced, Gilded Age Republican, anything but be like his father, until after he came home from World War I and he thought, maybe I'll read one of those books. And God, did he get hooked. No one's going to grow up like Warren did anymore, though, because none of us are going to have a grandfather who fought in the war. Robert Penn Warren, as some of you surely know, grew up in Guthrie, Kentucky, right on the Tennessee border. He's born in 1905. He spends his summers until he's about 12 or 13. Every summer, he'd go out to his grandfather's farm. Gabriel Penn was his grandfather. His grandfather had been a cavalry soldier in the Confederate Army. He rode with Nathan Bedford Forrest's army all over Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, etc., for 2.5 years, lived to tell it. And Warren would sit at his grandfather's, the foot of his grandfather's wicker chair, and his grandfather would chew on his corncob pipe, and they'd design battle campaigns on the ground with stones and shells, and he would regale his grandson with stories of the war, the kinds of songs they had sung at Shiloh, and on and on. And Warren came to write of it, and he did hundreds of interviews about it. Every time Red Warren had to do an interview the last 20 years of his life, he's constantly asked, so how did you get interested in the Civil War? And he tells the story over and over and over about Grandpa Penn. But you get the sense that Warren never tired of telling it. Warren would say, where I grew up, he said it was, quote, part of the emotional furniture of our lives. And then he would say things like, because everyone I knew had been in it. Or was the son or daughter of someone in it? This was border state civil war, Kentucky, Tennessee. By the way, his grandfather had never been able to go back into Tennessee again, according to Warren, because legally he would have been arrested for having hung some Yankee prisoners. Now, I think that's made up. That sounds like a good apocryphal story, but it's a nice one. His father would read poetry with him, usually romantic poets. Grandfather, excuse me. But out of that came a Robert Penn Warren with this insatiable fascination for this story. And frankly, he spent his life trying to get over the romance for that war that his grandfather had instilled in him. And he succeeded, frankly, quite well in so many of his writings. If you've ever read All the King's Men, Warren's greatest novel and arguably the greatest political novel ever written by an American, it is all about the Civil War. If you haven't read it, go back to it. I won't even dwell on that at all. And then there's the case of Bruce Catton. Bruce Catton would become the largest selling, most widely read narrative historian of the Civil War who ever lived. Shelby Foote doesn't even match him, doesn't even come close in sales, in sheer numbers of books. Catton was born in a little town way up in the upper part of the lower peninsula of Michigan, in what he called the cutover lumber district. He was born in a little town called Benzonia, Michigan. He's born in 1899, and he grows up all throughout his youth until his teens, hanging around town talking to the old GAR veterans, old Civil War veterans. He said they were always hanging out at the train station. And since there was nothing else to do in Benzonia, that's what a little boy did. And when Catton came to write a memoir, a brilliant, beautiful memoir, by the way, I highly recommend, still in print, he called it Waiting for the Morning Train. Because he said there was nothing else to do in Benzonia but wait for the morning train with the old Civil War veterans. And they would tell him stories. And every year on Memorial Day, Catton would follow them in their parades and worship these guys. Until he got a little older and got a little worried about his worship. Catton then went off to Oberlin College, dropped out of Oberlin in his junior year and joined the U.S. Navy in World War I, spent the last year of World War I on ships in the Atlantic, and would become part of that wonderful list of college dropout great writers. None of you think about that. Finish, and then go be a great writer. He spent 20 years as a journalist, which is where he learned to write so well, of course. He was unspoiled by the academy, so to speak. In newspapers all over the North, and in 1939, he went to work for the government. He became a very prominent bureaucrat in the federal government all through World War II. He worked for the War Production Board. He was actually the publicity director of the War Production Board, which is that agency that produces, that does all the negotiation of contracts between the government and private enterprise to build all the material of war. War ended, and he wrote his first book called The Warlords of Washington, which is a book all about that War Production Board. And Catton in that book, it's a brilliant book actually, argued that the United States government did not do enough in engaging private enterprise to support our troops, to build the material and the hardware of war, and basically lays out an argument that it's a near wonder that we won. But his true love was still this story of the Civil War, which he'd never written about. In 1948, he quit his job. He started hanging out at the Library of Congress every day, reading diaries and letters. And in 1951, published his first Civil War book. And over the next 21 years, he would publish 15 books, almost like delivering the new model of Chevys every other year, or every year, to his publisher, Doubleday, where he became the meal ticket of that publishing house. Mr. Lincoln's Army in 1951, Glory Road in 1953, Stillness at Appomattox in 1954, which won him the Pulitzer and the National Book Award, Book of the Month Club, and he was suddenly star quality, household name, Mr. Civil War Centennial by the late 50s. And I'll bet some of you have held in your hands the Great American Heritage Picture History of the Civil War, published in 1960, one of the largest selling such picture books ever produced. Catton wrote the 60,000-word narrative of that as well. He would then write another trilogy at the time of the centennial, 1961, The Coming Fury. 1963, The Terrible Swift Sword. And 1965, Never Call Retreat. He wrote children's books. He wrote three books on Grant. And on and on and on. There's a reason he did it, by the way. He had a full-time, terrific research assistant named E.B. Long, who was paid full-time by Doubleday. It's amazing. I've never encountered, and I've asked all over the place, any other example of anyone, any writer, having a full-time, fully paid by the publisher research assistant for 7 years. Wouldn't that be nice? I tell you that background story because the secret to Bruce Catton's success, and it tells us something about why we're attracted to this war, this event, this story, is that he had a genius for narrative, a true genius for storytelling. He was a great writer. Now, let me suggest that the first reason, and I'll tick off about six or seven of them and then leave it to you to add to our list, perhaps in the Q&A, perhaps the first reason we're attracted to this event is because, let's admit it, it's a great story. It's an epic story. Ken Burns is always out there telling us the Civil War is our Homeric epic. I think he used the word Homer three times in our panel at the New York Times. You know, it's our Homeric epic. Yeah, but what does that mean? Or when he has Shelby Foote sitting there, and they played the clip during our panel. They played the clip of Shelby sitting there saying, that war is the crossroads of our being. And the audience oohed and aahed, and I said, Ken, what does that mean? What the hell is the crossroads of our being? Well, it means it's a huge transforming moment of our history. It's the pivot of our history, and we had a really interesting discussion of that. But the first reason we're attracted probably is this is a great story. Think about it. When civilizations tear themselves to pieces, nations tear themselves apart, engage in one of the largest bloodlettings of modern history, destroy themselves legally and constitutionally from within, brother and father slaughter one another, in biblical ways, in biblical proportions, and something yet survives to be remade, that's a hell of a story. Let me just quote Bruce Catton twice to make the point. And by the way, I have a long chapter on Catton in this new book. No one's ever written anything about him. I think it's because us professional academic historians have either always resented him or not taken him seriously. He left massive papers, massive stuff. And in that massive papers are literally thousands of fan letters. That's what we envy. Boy, did he have fans. People would write to him and say, I'm reading your book slowly because I don't want it to end. When's the next one coming out? I need it. I want to buy 11 for Christmas, you know, for my aunts and uncles. For example, this is his ending of Glory Road, the book on the Gettysburg campaign, his second book published in 1953. This is a typical Catton ending. He's just described the beginnings of the event at the cemetery in November of 63 at Gettysburg. Lincoln's coming to Gettysburg, the train, the whole thing. And then he says, quote, there were many thousands of people at this ceremony, and among them were certain wounded veterans who had come back to see all of this, and a knot of these wandered away from the crowd at the speaker's stand and strolled down along Cemetery Ridge. I love quoting this here because most of you know exactly where Cemetery Ridge is. When you do this in Kalamazoo or in Los Angeles, they don't necessarily know. Pausing, he says, when they reached the little clump of trees, and there they looked off toward the west and talked quietly about what they had seen and done there. Only Catton had the audacity to actually steal a few words from Lincoln or steal a few words from the Battle Hymn of the Republic and actually put them into his own prose. The rest of us wouldn't do that. In front of them was a wide, gentle valley of the shadow of death, brimming now in the autumn light. And the voice went on. He's describing, of course, Edward Everett's 2.5-hour, paon to Pericles. And the governors looked dignified, and the veterans by the trees looked about them and saw again the fury and the smoke and the killing. This was the valley of the dry bones, waiting for the word, which might or might not come in rhythmic prose. The bones had laid there in the sun and the rain, and now they were carefully arranged state by state under the new sod. They were bones of men who had exulted in their youth, and some of them had been unstained heroes, while others had been scamps who pillaged and robbed and ran away when they could, and they had all died here. Back of these men were innumerable long dusty roads reaching to the main streets of 1,000 youthful towns and villages where there had been bright flags overhead and people on the board sidewalks cheering and crying and waving a last goodbye. Perhaps there was a meaning to all of it somewhere. Perhaps everything that the nation was and meant to be had come to focus here beyond the graves. Perhaps the whole of it somehow was greater than the sum of its tragic parts. And perhaps here, on this windswept hill, the thing could be said at last so that the dry bones of the country's dreams could take on flesh. The orator finished, and after the applause had died away, the tall man in the black frock coat got to his feet with two little sheets of paper in his hand, and he looked out over the valley. And he began to speak. And the book ends. He didn't quote the Gettysburg Address. He gets loads of letters. There's two schools of thought. Some of his readers say, "Why didn't you quote the Gettysburg Address, for God's sake? I was just waiting for the words." And others say, "Oh, that's beautiful. What a subtle ending. I went and read it for myself, But that's a typical Catton ending. The guy's a storyteller. He knows he's got a great story. Or take this little moment in Terrible Swift Sword, published in 1963. Boy, did he have timing. This is his book about the Antietam campaign, of course, and the emancipation moment, 1963. And only Catton would have the audacity to do what he did with language in this passage. I quote, "There was nobility in the idea that there ought to be a peace without victory. Yet in August of 1862, America's tragedy was that it was caught between the madness of going on with the war and the human impossibility of stopping it. Neither Mr. Lincoln nor Mr. Davis was going to assume anything of the kind. Each man was fighting for a dreadful simplicity. Neither one could describe a solution acceptable to him without describing something wholly unacceptable to the other. Neither man could accept anything less than complete victory without admitting complete defeat." That's a definition of authentic tragedy without having to use the word. And then he ends, "The peacemakers could not be heard until the terrible swift sword had been sheathed, but the scabbard had been thrown away, and now the Confederacy was carrying the war into the enemy's country." It's a great story. That alone might be all the reason we need for never getting over it, because we just love to hear the same stories over and over. Or do we? Secondly, let's admit it. Some people are attracted, to use the words that Warren was challenged with again, to this event over and over and over and over again, because they're attracted to the pleasure of detail, the pleasure of military detail, the pleasure of battle campaigns drawn out on boards or drawn out on the ground or drawn out in the kind of interior battlefields of our minds. You can say that of other wars. You can say that of other events. But there's no other event in our history where we do this as much, where there's such an industry of appealing to the pleasure of detail. And by the way, that didn't just start with the Civil War centennial and automobile heritage tourism. It actually started with the former veterans themselves. I found lots of examples of this when I was doing Race and Reunion, of veterans sitting in those old veterans' homes who themselves, with nothing else to do, would just start redrawing battle maps, remembering their experiences in linear ways, in spatial ways, on maps. And then they would sometimes even send them to magazines and try to get something published. They would, you know, get $10 for it if they could, like a commodity. Or thirdly, maybe we're drawn to this event, some of us. Lots of people wouldn't openly admit this, probably, but are we not sometimes drawn to lost causes? To the lost cause tradition? To that sometimes quite deep, sentimental, seeming nobility of the side that lost, of the Confederacy? That interesting, that fascinating, unique thing in our history, the Confederacy. There's never been anything else like it. It's the greatest dissent in our history. Right? Name a bigger dissent than 11 states seceding from the Union and going into an all-out war for their independence. We've had other big dissents in our history. Nothing that big. And they really lost. Isn't defeat sometimes more interesting than victory? There are scholars of nostalgia, theoretical scholars of nostalgia, who argue that, you know, the deepest forms of nostalgia are for not only those things that we feel like we've lost, but those things that we have ourselves destroyed. There's a deep, deep mythology in the Lost Cause tradition that does not die and is not only advocated by neo-Confederates sometimes. The new movie that just premiered yesterday, The Conspirator, a very well-made film, by the way. Robert Redford, the director, this is the film about Mary Surratt and the Booth conspiracy, the Lincoln murder, made by this brand new film company called the American Film Company, their first time out. That's a film company, by the way, completely devoted to making movies about history. There's no other film company, I can assure you, trying to do that. And I am rooting for this movie, even if I don't like it all, it doesn't matter. I just want them to succeed so they can keep making more history movies because they're the only ones interested. And their money, by the way, it comes from this guy named Ricketts who created Ameritrade and also is a huge supporter of, well, I don't want to say that. You're videotaping this. It's all right. It's good. Fourthly, or fifth, whatever number I'm on, maybe we're also drawn finally because of 50, 60, 70 years of scholarship and 30, 40 to 50 years of schooling and teaching and curriculum change and textbook changes. And today, the ubiquity of possible learning and information, maybe we are finally drawn to this event because it is, by God, the destruction of the First American Republic and the birth of the Second. And there is a consensus, at least among mainstream historians, and not just academic historians, that the Civil War did bring about, it's Lincoln's principal metaphor, of course, in the Gettysburg Address, a rebirth, a recreation, a redefinition, a remaking of the United States in the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments, and the first Civil Rights Acts, and the Reconstruction Acts. If indeed the Civil War and Reconstruction are our second founding, then we need a new language about founder mania. I, for one, would like to create, I'd like to advocate, and no one will do this, and I don't have any resources to do it, but I think we need 10,000 14th Amendment clubs around the United States. They would be local clubs and society. You know, if I ruled the world, you ever been to one of those retreats where everyone gets up for 3 minutes and says, all right, if you could change the United States and rule the world, what would you do? I'd bore the hell out of everybody, and I'd create 14th Amendment clubs in every town in the United States. And they would be centers and forums for understanding transformation of the United States in John Bingham's Article 1 of the 14th Amendment. John Bingham should be a national hero. John Bingham should have a statue in the Capitol. He wrote the Equal Protection Clause, which protects you every day of your lives. It's the umbrella you live under. It has more to do with defining what an American is than anything else. But most of us don't even know what the 14th Amendment is. Well, although in our politics of late, the
there's been a reason to learn what the 14th Amendment is, because part of our political culture has decided they'd like to get rid of birthright citizenship. Not a good idea, in my humble opinion. And maybe we've also finally reached some kind of consensus, and this is, if not to be celebrated, certainly to be recognized, that since the centennial of the Civil War, 50 years out now, I think there is some sort of consensus in this culture that the Civil War was our first great racial reckoning. I don't think you could safely say that in so many forums, or it wasn't even said, period, at the centennial. And the Civil War Centennial Commission, the official national federal Civil War Centennial Commission, even under its new leadership in late 1961 of Allen Nevins and Bud Robertson, who did their, you know, their heroic best to create a reasonably inclusive centennial commemoration, they tiptoed around race so much it is almost pathetic to look back at it in retrospect. Now, we know why, of course, because the Civil Rights Revolution was going on at the same time. It was so difficult. Even when they held the commemoration at the Lincoln Memorial, September 22, 1962, of the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, when they planned the program, they hadn't planned to have any black people on the platform. Now, it's hard to believe in retrospect, you know, but you gotta, when you get back inside the culture of 1962 and even who's running the things in the Kennedy White House, it's not entirely. The keynote speaker that day was supposed to be John Kennedy. I mean, after all, he's the president. You're not going to flank him with too many Martin Luther Kings. But by the way, Kennedy took that day off. He decided politically he wasn't going to do that one. He went to a yacht race in Nantucket, and they sent Adlai Stevenson. He was the secretary of the UN, but because he had been from Illinois, Lincoln, Illinois, Adlai Stevenson. And at the last minute, under great pressure, they got Thurgood Marshall to sit on the platform and make brief remarks, and of course Mahalia Jackson to sing the battle hymn as an afterthought. Now we look back at that and we think, God, what were they thinking? Well, there was no consensus 50 years ago that the Civil War was about slavery and its greatest result was emancipation and it transformed the country in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. There was no consensus that it had been a great racial reckoning. There is now, I hope. I hope. So, those are just some thoughts. I also think we are attracted to this event because it is about loss. I said something about lost causes, but think about it for a moment. When we encounter this event, even if it's for 1 hour in a classroom or a week or one book we might read or one visit we might make to an exhibition in a museum, we are usually confronted with those statistics. 625,000 dead soldiers, maybe 1.2 million wounded, uncounted numbers of civilians. There are actually people now trying to study civilian death in the Civil War. I mean, we're never going to have any kind of official numbers on that. There are a lot of people studying contraband camps now. These were the encampments created for fugitive slaves who were escaping into Union lines from early 1861 on. And we are getting some interesting... I just chaired a panel at the Organization of American Historians of three young scholars writing on contraband camps. And one statistic that came out of that was that in all the escaped slaves that made it into Union lines, in the entire Mississippi Valley, which was the densest slave population of all, during the war, probably one in four died in those camps of disease. The scale of loss in this war is unlike anything Americans have ever experienced since, and you perhaps have heard this statistic. If you took per capita the 620-some thousand dead in the American Civil War, that's just the soldiers. You move that ahead to the Vietnam era, in the Vietnam War, where we lost 60-some thousand in Vietnam. You took the Civil War dead to the Vietnam era per capita, we would have lost 5 million in Vietnam. That's the scale of loss in the society of the Civil War era. Would Americans ever sustain 5 million dead in a war? I mean, I don't want to know the answer to that, and neither do you. If bin Laden's coming through that door with his guys, maybe we would. I don't want to know that we would ever have to do that. But loss attracts us to a story. Sometimes it attracts us in an elegiac way because we're still collectively mourning it. I just learned this statistic last week from Adam Goodhart, who was on this panel in New York. I didn't know this. I'm sure some of you did. Somebody did a study, I don't know who, and has some data that says that one of every three Americans still today had an ancestor in the Civil War. I was stunned at that. I wouldn't have guessed it would be that high. With all the massive new immigrants of the 20th century from Asia and the Caribbean and Mexico and all over the world, one of three of us can trace lineage to somebody who was in the Civil War. That may continue to say something about why we're attracted, why we can't give it up. And, of course, in the end, its issues never go away. I want to come back to that just in a minute, with just a brief take on the roiling legacies of the Civil War that are all around us now, whether we want it or not. Its issues don't really go away. And that could, at the end of the day, have as much to do with why we're attracted to the event as anything else, possibly. Well, legacies. Yes, we have an African-American president. That's still a phenomenon that some of us have to pinch ourselves and believe, right? Don't know where you were or what you did on the night of Obama's election. 52.5% of us who voted for him. 47 point something did not. But about 52.5% of us in this country were weeping that night. Sometimes legacies are visible. Sometimes they're not. Those tears that night have become one of the most vivid legacies of the Civil War in my personal memory. And I'll never forget the next day in the New York Times when Tom Friedman wrote an editorial with the frankly ridiculous opening sentence, "Last night at 10 p.m. in Grant Park in Chicago, United States of America, the Civil War ended." And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, God. Wouldn't that it were true? I mean, I wanted it to be. That'd be bad for business for Matt and me, you know. But it wasn't quite over, was it? It wasn't quite over. Legacies. Put aside the racial legacies of the Civil War for the moment. Put aside the brutal, growing inequalities in this country between rich and poor, which is still very racialized. Put aside all those numbers about incarceration, which is deeply racialized. Put aside the revival of white supremacy groups since Obama's election. Put all that aside, if you want. Put all the racial legacies aside for the moment and just look at states' rights. There's a political persuasion in the United States now that has gained power. That's not news. If this sounds partisan, I apologize. But it's not news that all over state legislatures in the United States and in the U.S. Congress, there is a vigorous revival of this debate over federalism. It's not just an attack on big government, an argument against big government, an argument that there's too much government regulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's been part of our politics since, well before Reagan. It's been a part of our politics since the Republicans of the 1930s resisted the New Deal. It's been part of our politics forever. Our debate over federalism is as American as apple pie, right? It's as old as the Constitution. It's as old as where those guys got it from philosophically in our divided government, our overlapping institutions. But some of the things happening in our state legislatures today are a revival of secessionist rhetoric and action and the rhetoric of nullification. It is nullification by any other name. Just a few examples. The state of Kentucky has a bill before its legislature which would declare Kentucky a, quote, sanctuary from the Equal Protection Agent, the federal Equal Protection Environmental Protection Agency, excuse me, not the Equal Protection Law. That's the 14th Amendment. There are other states trying to declare, in effect, null and void the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. You can decide what you think of that, but it is an act by a state to nullify even the existence of a certain kind of federal agency. The state of Arizona has a bill before its legislature that wants to exempt all products made within its borders from federal interstate commerce laws. Montana is considering a bill to nullify, quote, actual words being used in the bill, nullify federal laws that protect endangered species. All sorts of attacks in the West on the Endangered Species Act. Georgia's legislature has a bill to require banks to accept payment in gold and silver. God, thought that one was over in the 1890s. Not so. Another Arizona bill would make it a felony to enforce federal commerce laws. Montana, lots of good ones coming out of Montana, even though they have a Democratic governor. Their Republican-controlled legislature has a bill that would require the Federal Bureau of Investigation to get a local sheriff's permission to ever make an arrest. The FBI has to get... We did this with Bull Connor. You know, we have a history with this. Utah. We got a Utah contingent. I'm sorry, I'm going to give you some Utah example, folks. Utah passed a bill in 2010 that would use eminent domain to seize federal land by the state. And on it goes. I mean, there are many, many more of these if you want to go out and check it out on the internet or in the press. Our debate over federalism now, the relationship of the states to federal government, the relationship of federal power to state power, localism to the central state, is without doubt a revisitation of many of these principles and issues that do lie at the root of what happened in the Civil War. Now, having said that, of course, it's been a mantra for generations and generations that the Civil War was essentially caused by states' rights. It's all about states' rights. And it's not about slavery. And just for a second or two, when we think about what we're attracted to in this story, I want to make one other point about it. When we think about why this issue never goes away, there's a Harris poll out. I only learned this from the Time magazine piece. The Harris Polling Organization did a poll. Granted, this is only in the 11 ex-Confederate states, but they found that 2/3 of white people in the 11 ex-Confederate states, maybe this wouldn't surprise you, it's still a little disturbing, when asked, said the principal cause of the Civil War was states' rights and not slavery. Now, there's also a CNN poll that was just released this week. And I don't know if this is glass half full or glass half empty. You can decide. It said that 52% of Americans now believe the Civil War was rooted mostly in slavery. Now, maybe we should celebrate that. We've tipped over a majority, ladies and gentlemen, on a question that has been an absolute consensus among historians for generations. But out in the public mind, out in the public realm, where there's far, far, far more public historical memory than there ever is history we write, it doesn't matter what we do. You cannot kill the idea that somehow this war, this terrible bloodletting, it just couldn't be about slavery. We want mostly to be the country that freed the slaves, not the country that owned them. We don't want to be the country that owned 4 million people as property and had the second largest system of slavery or bond labor on planet Earth, only next to Russian serfdom. We don't want to be the country where the largest financial asset in the entire economy in 1860 was slaves, which were worth about $3.5 billion, and that was worth more than all manufacturing, all railroads, and all business enterprise put together. We would much rather be the country that freed the slaves. Because what we most want from this war, understandably, what we most want from this tragedy is the unity that came out of it. We have spent so much energy in our culture, so many books, so many public rituals, so much popular culture, so many darky stories, so many cartoons, So many horrible movies to demonstrate that the Civil War was essentially the way that we just got better and just got greater and just got more unified. We've given so many happy endings to this terrible story. William Dean Howells nailed it right on the head in 1900 when he said, "What the American people always like is a tragedy as long as it has a happy ending." Unity. Who's against that? I'm not against that. The Union had to be put back together. The Southern states had to be reincorporated into the Union. The problem was that Americans, and let's give them credit, they had a terrible dilemma. They, we, our ancestors. Because in the wake of our Civil War, our great-great-grandparents had to do what every other culture in the world has had to do after bloodlettings like this, after massive civil wars, after great cataclysms. They had to face two profound and conflicting and unbalanced ideas. On the one hand was the idea of healing. They had to heal. They had to put the Confederate States back in the Union. There had to be readmission to the Union by some method, some means. The Constitution was frankly pretty silent on this. Didn't give them a lot of direction. They had to heal homes and families and people. They had to heal these poor veterans, if they could. But the other profound idea they faced was justice. But justice for whom? Justice by whom? Justice by what means? What would justice mean to a white family who'd lost two sons and all of their property in the face of Sherman's march to the sea in central or eastern Georgia? What was justice to a former Confederate general? What was justice to Jubal Early, who fled to Mexico? Should have stayed. All the havoc he raised in the Lost Cause, but anyway. What was justice to Jefferson Davis, who was arrested, held at Fort Monroe for 2 years, but they never charged him, they never indicted him. They never did any justice. We could argue whether they should or not. What was justice to a mother in the North who lost a husband and two sons? What is justice to a widow? Maybe there can't be any. And what was justice to the 4 million freedmen and their children? What was justice to the freed people? They were given freedom of some kind, legally some rights of some kind. But precious little justice as the years of Reconstruction worked their way through. Healing and justice. Look around the world. Look at modern history. Look at all the great wars. Look at all great civil wars in the bloodiest century in all human history, the 20th century. And you will find this terrible, vexing, unbalanced problem, healing versus justice. How do you do it? Look what happened after World War II. We created the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We attempted to create international regimes to hold planet Earth together, if it was possible. We basically ended up holding it together in the Cold War by mutual assured destruction with nuclear weapons. Not the best idea. It seems to have worked. Healing and justice. I would also just leave you with this. I may sound sobering. I love this subject as much as anybody else. In fact, I'll never forget as long as I live. My good friend Drew Faust, who's now the president of Harvard, before she became president of Harvard, about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, we do an every other year conference out at the Huntington Library in California, where I'm actually right now on a fellowship. Every other year there's a conference on the Civil War, and we always invent some new topic, and we all claim we're an expert on whatever the new topic is so we can just get another invitation to go back out to Pasadena. And I don't know what the topic... No, the topic that year was memory, of course, right? But Drew gave the opening paper. And it's been published in Civil War History. It's in a scholarly journal if you want to find it. You can easily find it by Googling it. And the title of the piece is Why We Love the Civil War. And here was Drew Faust, this terrific scholar of the Old South, the pro-slavery argument of women in the Civil War, a great social historian, and on and on and on. And she wrote this poignant,
really quite
satirical at times, almost bitter essay about why we love this event.
She ticked off a whole list of quotations over and over and over. The famous quote, the opening, of course, the title, in fact, is drawn from Robert E. Lee's famous line that he apparently said at Fredericksburg, "It is good that war is so horrible, lest we grow too fond of it." Well, what happened was, and the paper was brilliant, but after that, everybody who got up to speak for the next 2 days, there were like 12 more of us, to Jim McPherson, everybody had to get up and do their papers. And everybody had to get up after that and say why they loved the Civil War. And it got worse and worse and worse, confessionals throughout 2 days. And they're like, the reason I grew up, I love it, I can't help it, and on and on. Pretty soon the audience was saying, all right already, just give your paper, you know. But we all, it was fascinating, and we spent 2 days ending up talking about this. All right, what's your story? What is it you love about this? Why do we love such a horrible war? Well, I can't answer that entirely. I know where my boyhood interests came, and Bruce Kattner's responsible. I started reading him as a teenager. In my summer jobs, I used to pray for rain so I could just go hide and read Bruce Kattner. And I think I read Stillness at Appomattox when I was about 15. But I guess if I love this subject now, it is because it makes me hurt. And as an American citizen, it should make us hurt as we study it, learn it, ingest it, know everything we can make about it, learn about it, and then take that learning out into the world. Because what the Civil War is ultimately at its heart is an authentic tragedy. And there are many ways to define tragedy. In some ways, the term, the idea, tragedy almost defies any absolute definition. It's had so many definitions ever since the Greek playwrights. And it went through all sorts of redefinitions in the Middle Ages. And then Shakespeare gave it an entirely new Elizabethan kind of definition. The Bible has so many different variations, the greatest of which is probably the book of Job. Tragedy always somehow involves this question of fate. It's what Robert Penn Warren was a genius at. It's why you must read Robert Penn Warren. I think you should have to read Robert Penn Warren to have U.S. citizenship, but that's just my opinion. It means an event, an experience that we may or may not control. We may or may not be in control of our destiny. We may like to think we're in control of our destiny, and then history hits us right between the eyes. How many times are you surprised by history? Who saw Egypt coming 2 months ago? Anybody? Who saw the end of the Cold War? Nobody. Who saw Pearl Harbor? A few folks in the State Department. The reason history hits us between the eyes usually, and we shouldn't get too smug about it, is because we're human. And we want history to be, particularly Americans want this. I mean, this seems to me almost in our water, in our DNA as Americans. We seem to believe that we are born with the right to have a history of progress. Right? We're a people of progress. We're a people who solve their problems. We're always an escalator up. I mean, you may flatten out sometimes and the mechanism may break, but we get it fixed and we go back up again. The escalator is always up in this country. And every president has to say that. Obama's very good at it. They all have to. But is that what history really is? The problem we've had with our Civil War is that it's very difficult to fit an all-out civil war like this that destroys so many people and so much property and so much treasure into a story of progress. But we've done that. We just got better for it. And with Robert Penn Warren, we're the dog looking at the icebox. We just love to look at it.
I want to end with a... Well, and you know, tragedy, there are many forms of tragedy, and in literary terms, often tragedies, of course, are those stories through which we gain certain catharsis, right? We learn something, we feel and experience something, and sometimes we're redeemed by it. You can decide whether Job got redeemed or not. And there's some characters, did King Lear get redeemed? I mean, there are plenty of tragic characters that don't get redeemed, and then there's some that are. I just would end with a little story about James Baldwin. Now, Baldwin, as some of you know, was a great American, African-American writer, born very differently than the other three writers I've mentioned, Edmund Wilson, Bruce Catton, and Robert Penn Warren. Baldwin was born, he's the next generation, he was born in 1924 into absolute poverty in Harlem. He was born at 31st and Park Avenue. 131st, excuse me, in Park Avenue in New York. It makes a difference. As Baldwin used to say, the uptown Park Avenue. Ever since I learned that, I've never been able to take the Metro North train, which I take all the time from New Haven to New York City, because it goes right, literally right over the corner where Baldwin was born. The house isn't there anymore. 9 children, terrible father, horrible father, storefront preacher, angry, angry man. But he got an education in good New York schools, couldn't go to college because he had no money, wanted to be a writer, lived in Greenwich Village, ended up going to France, spent 9 years there, didn't come back to the United States, went through all sorts of horrible traumas with psychological depression, drinking, the rest. Published his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, which is a brilliant story about religion. He came back to the United States in 1957 for the first time and entered the civil rights movement. He also went into the South for the first time, where his parents had grown up in Jim Crow and saw Jim Crow for himself when he was 32 years old. And he became the great essayist, the great nonfiction writer of the civil rights movement. Read his collections of essays, folks. Notes of a Native Son, one collection, Nobody Knows My Name, the other collection. And his most famous book, The Fire Next Time, published in 1963, was the best-selling book in the United States for most of the year, 1963. I've run into people, in fact, recently, who will tell you where they were the first time they read The Fire Next Time. But Baldwin also wrote a little essay in 1965, and I will end with this. It places us somewhere with our feet. Baldwin had just been, this was February of 1965, he had just been in England. He had just done a debate. He did zillions of these debates all over the place, usually on college campuses. He had just debated William F. Buckley at the Oxford Union, at Oxford University in England, and wiped the floor with him. Of course, Buckley had no chance. It was a setup. It was 600 Oxford undergraduates watching James Baldwin debate the civil rights movement with William Buckley, the great conservative. And 3 days after that, Malcolm X was murdered at the Apollo Theater in New York City in Harlem. 2 weeks after that, 600 civil rights marchers were brutally beaten by sheriff's deputies and state police on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. Bloody Sunday, one of the most important markers in the entire history of the civil rights movement. If anything, at that moment, Baldwin's little book, published in 63, The Fire Next Time, quote, of course, coming from the Bible, seemed a bit too prophetic about the possibilities of violence. By late March, Baldwin was himself in Selma to participate in the voter registration drive and ultimately in the then famous, or soon to become famous, march from Selma to Montgomery, March 25 to 29, along with about 30,000 other people. Baldwin joined the throng as it swelled on the highways, and he was with the crowd, the march, before it reached the city of Montgomery, capital of Alabama, birthplace of the Confederacy. Now, and he isn't going to miss a beat, as he described it. To see just what was at stake in the clashing versions of the history and memory of the Civil War era, with all the resonances of the Civil Rights era, this little remembrance by Baldwin in 1965 tells the tale. The voice, as he was now called, he was often called the voice of the Civil Rights Revolution, was powerfully alive in the essay entitled Unnameable Objects, Unspeakable Crimes, which he published later that summer in Ebony Magazine.
Baldwin charted the ways whites and blacks had forged segregated and deeply suspicious historical memories in this country. And drawing off Cold War imagery, he argued that Americans had built what he called a color curtain in their lives and in their historical consciousness, which he says, quote, may prove to be more deadly than any iron curtain of which we speak so much. The color curtain. Baldwin used a refrain in this essay of distance, he kept saying. Distance between white and blacks. Distance between whites and themselves. Distance between the stories within, within which people claimed they were living. And as the celebratory marchers arrived in the center of Montgomery, Alabama, Baldwin noticed that a Confederate flag was flying from the Capitol Dome. And then that the federalized Alabama National Guard, which had been ordered at that point by President Johnson to protect the marchers, quote, wore Confederate flags on their jackets. All they're being protected by guys with Confederate flags. All along the road, wrote Baldwin, older black men and women who have endured unspeakable oppression for so long waved and cheered and wept. In the white section of town, Baldwin saw businessmen, quote, on balconies jeering, their maids in back doors being silent. And then he says, a, quote, beige-colored woman standing on a street corner, a bit nervous, suddenly stepped off and joined the marchers. And with a small American flag in his hand, Baldwin marched next to Harry Belafonte, his fellow Harlem-born comrade, who also, by the way, happened to be a U.S. Navy veteran of World War II, which, a fact I think most people don't know about Harry Belafonte. We remember him as the most gorgeous man in America and through Calypso. White secretaries in upstairs office windows kept extending, says Baldwin, thumbs down signs to the marchers until suddenly many of them saw the stunningly handsome, quote, reigning matinee idol, Belafonte, in the crowd. When they saw that beautiful cat, said Baldwin, these women demonstrated that America was, quote, the most desperately schizophrenic of republics. Baldwin's storytelling prose, as well as insight, were never in better form. This was vintage Baldwin, race, sex, and his country, all on extraordinary display and the subject of his scorching satirical pen. Those young women in the windows, Baldwin declared, quote, could only look forward to an alliance with one of those jeering businessmen. And they were, quote, female, a word which in the context of the color curtain has suffered the same fate as the word male. Baldwin did not miss his chance. When those girls saw Harry Belafonte, he writes, a collision occurred in them so visible as to be at once hilarious and unutterably sad. At one moment, the thumbs were down. They were barricaded within their skins. At the next moment, those downturned thumbs flew to their mouths. Their faces changed. And exactly like bobby soxers, they oohed and they aahed and they moaned. God knows what was happening in the minds and hearts of those girls. Perhaps they just wanted to be free. Out of imagery only he might have seen, in a world historical moment, amidst the joy and solemnity of the spectacular Selma March, Baldwin made art out of all the real people around him, barricaded in their skins. On the eve of the centennial of the surrender at Appomattox, in the city where the Confederacy was born, Baldwin tried to kill that old story, the Confederacy. Tried to kill it as he asked everyone to see into a new history as they never had before. And after all, he too had just wanted to be loved and just wanted to be free. Thank you.
And I'm told the students take over now for Q&A. I'm all yours.
So during our question and answer session, please raise your hand and wait for a student with a microphone to reach you.
Oh, he talks so much about tragedy. Who wants to ask questions about that? There we are. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to point here. That's just a habit.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight. Just on the topic of lost causes and memory, do you believe that the glamorization of the South as a gallant people and a tragic lost cause, as popularized so poignantly by Gone with the Wind, one of the greatest American films ever made, do you think that that came from just a nostalgia for the lost cause, or do you think that is actually rooted in a desire to defend the racist practices of Southern America in the first half of the 20th century?
I suspect you've answered your own question. I think I agree with you that it's the latter. However, it is worth pointing out, as you just did, again, I learned this, I think, from the Time Magazine reporter. People Magazine just did a survey, greatest movies in American history, and Gone with the Wind came in number one again. Now, that might be because it's a great motion picture. It's a great piece of movie making. It really is. But it's still above Avatar. It's above Titanic. It's above everything else still. So, great question. No, the glamorization, I think you said, or valorization of the lost cause comes from a deep cultural history of the late 19th century, which is both a phenomenon of public culture, public popular culture, as well as politics, as well as ritual. Look, by 1900, certainly by 1910 and 11, at the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, certain Confederates, certain Southerners have become national heroes, namely Robert E. Lee. And certain aspects of the lost cause had become almost common coin for the whole country. That doesn't mean everybody in the North is buying into every aspect of the lost cause. But frankly, the real secret to understanding the success of the lost cause tradition, which can be defined a lot of ways, but basically it is this cluster of ideas that begins with the notion, when Southerners said they never really were fully defeated on the battlefield, they were only defeated by superior numbers and resources, they were defeated by an industrial Goliath, their cause was just, their cause was noble, and good and noble causes can lose. But the real success of the lost cause is when its arguments became not about loss at all, but about victory. And the victory narrative embedded in the lost cause was the story of the nation's victory over Reconstruction, which by, again, 1900, 1910, 1920, what scholars call the Dunning School of American historiography, but it isn't just the Dunning School, it's the whole popular cultural belief system that said Reconstruction was a period in which the country went to hell in a handbasket, black people were given all these rights and liberties they were incapable of practicing, the South needed to be given back control of its own society, and most important, the Ku Klux Klan was a good thing in helping them bring that about. Immortalized, of course, in the great motion picture Birth of a Nation in 1915. Based upon, of course, Thomas Dixon's novel, The Klansman, which sold 1 million copies in 1905, 1906. An absolute bestseller. In fact, Dixon's book is only the tip of the iceberg. Ku Klux Klan apologetic literature, nonfiction and fiction, was a huge genre from about 1895 to 1910, 1915, part of a national readership about a period that needed to be survived. And, well, so we have this Jim Crow system and this, you know, kind of official legal white supremacy, but perhaps it was the only good outcome that could come. In fact, it's hard to convey, but the lost cause tradition was so mainstream in America 50 years ago, at the time of the centennial, that even good liberal Democrats like Bruce Catton Edmund Wilson, although I don't really know much about his voting patterns, were in effect believers in it. They really were. And in part, I think, because they themselves, these guys are geniuses, but they didn't really understand. They hadn't learned it. It hadn't been written much. They hadn't really learned what a racial ideology, the lost cause ideology, became. So your question's a great one, because it's a historical question. You must be a history major.
From the research, your own extensive research and the research that you know of that your colleagues have done, what were Confederate soldiers telling, and I assume there were a number of streams of what they were saying, but what were they saying when they wrote home, when they wrote to each other, about why they were fighting?
Yeah, well, I have not done my own deep research by any means on the on-the-ground letter writing and diary keeping of Confederate soldiers, although there are some wonderful books on that. We could cite books. It's a great question because it goes to this issue of, well, so how could this war be all about slavery when the vast majority of Confederate soldiers never owned a slave and never would have had a chance to own a slave? It's one of the oldest chestnuts we have. And it's frankly deeply at the root of our current neo-Confederate or Sons of Confederate Veterans take on the Civil War. They said that many things. They said they were fighting for the men next to them. They said they were fighting for home and hearth. They said they were fighting for their families. They said they were fighting for the social order as they knew it. I mean, they didn't write home every day and say, I'm fighting to protect slavery for that planter down the road who owns slaves. I know we never will, but he does. Isn't that good to fight for? They didn't write that explicitly. But we do have books like Chandra Manning's recent book, What This Cruel War Was Over is the title. And she has done perhaps the most extensive reading of Civil War soldier letters, although most of her books about the Union soldiers. It's partly about Confederate soldiers. And Jim McPherson's book called For Cause and Comrades, an extensive reading of, which Pat McPherson, his wife, Jim's a fabulous historian, but I know Pat likes to get some recognition for that book because she did a lot of those letters. But they read thousands of Civil War letters, and they came up with the same argument Chandra Manning did and others have, that, you know, the average Civil War soldier was no dummy. They did tend to have a deep sense of cause, a purpose of ideology. On the northern side, it had a great deal with this concept, this abstraction of union and holding the union together, holding the Constitution together. And secession was such a threat to these men because they believed they lived in a kind of social order that was now utterly threatened, would fall to pieces. The economy would fall to pieces. The future would fall to pieces. They couldn't give their children a future like they had if the country was divided and split in two and torn apart. Southerners said they were fighting for home. I mean, a good example can be found in Ed Ayer's book, In the Presence of Mine Enemies. It's a marvelous micro-history of two counties. Is it Augusta County in Virginia, where Stanton, Virginia is? And then it's the county around Chambersburg. Is it this county? Franklin County, exactly. Right next door to you, right? He did it, and it was all rooted in what was originally his website called The Valley of the Shadow. But the book In Presence of Mine Enemies, which takes the story up through 1863, studies in depth these two counties, barely 100 miles apart or maybe 125 miles apart. They share a topography, a terrain, their family ties. They share an economic tie that is very deep. But one fights for the Confederacy, one fights for the South. And in that book, you can see in letter after letter that's quoted, newspaper editorial after newspaper editorial, that county in Virginia voted against secession the first time Virginia held a secession convention, which I guess was today. You had it up here, April 16. Well, it was 150 years ago today. We're going to keep doing that for the next 5 years. It happened today. No, it was 150 years ago. Until Fort Sumter. In the wake of Fort Sumter, there's nothing like real war to prompt people to have to choose. And It wasn't just Fort Sumter, of course. It was Lincoln's, what, 48 hours later? Call for 75,000 volunteers to, quote, put down the rebellion or domestic insurrection. Lincoln, in effect, announced war on the South. That's all some Virginians needed to hear. They didn't want to, but they thought they were about to be invaded. Now, 2 years later, you know, let's say during the Antietam campaign, or 3 years, a year later in the Antietam campaign, 2 years later in the Gettysburg campaign, and so on and so forth, by 1864, in the horrifying stalemate of the Overland campaign in Virginia, still though, I mean, after all the suffering, all the death, all the sacrifice, all the loss, now they're not only fighting for home, for locality, for place, for the society as they know it, for the racial order as they know it. Lots of non-slaveholding Confederate soldiers would write and talk about fighting to sustain a kind of, we call it a racial order. They wouldn't necessarily call it a racial system. But they were as troubled or frightened by this abolitionist threat as others. But now, of course, you're also fighting because the war's gone on so long. They burned your villages. What do you do when somebody burns your village? You go burn theirs. And they did, right? Chambersburg got burned by Jubal Early, late in the war. War makes more war. I love your question because one of the significant turns we've had in Civil War scholarship, Matt knows this, others here know this, of the last, really of my generation, your generation as well, maybe we're not the same generation, is this kind of deep social history of common soldiers, deep social history of women on the home front. Drew Faust wrote Mothers of Invention, the book about Southern women. Nina Sobers done a wonderful book on Northern women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have a huge literature now on emancipation. Even though most slaves were illiterate, we have a huge record of what's going on among the freed slaves. We know so much more now about what the average person believed this war was about while they were engaging in it than we did 50 years ago. And many of these books are now widely read and widely taught. It's to be celebrated that this social history revolution that's been going on for half a century. In fact, one of the reasons it's happened with Civil War scholarship better in some ways than other fields is because there was so much great letter writing during this period. And Ken Burns demonstrated that, of course, in his film series. And he put so many of them in voices like Garrison Keillor and others. Yes. Another one on this side. This side's dominating here.
I would like to ask a question about your comment. The morning after Obama was elected, You commented in the newspaper, it said, the Civil War is finally over. Right. Well, my question is, presidents usually have to be pretty politically correct. Why did Michelle Obama make the comment, this is the first time I'm proud to be an American?
Because she probably slipped and said exactly what she believes. Beyond that, you'd have to ask her. It sounded really honest to me. But she's learned from that, hasn't she? She doesn't do that anymore. She's writing a book, by the way, about the White House garden. Not going there again. And I'm sure it'll be a great book on a garden.
We have time for one more question this evening.
There's one up here, I think.
Professor Blythe, thanks for coming. The reason I love the Civil War...
We're getting confessions. Good. Pass that mic when you're done.
I'm fascinated at, for me, what the Civil War represents is the survival of the ideology of white supremacy. Uh-huh. How, despite the cataclysm of the Civil War, we see, you know, a few years later that we're still pretty much dealing with the same idea, white supremacy.
Yeah.
I read recently Douglas Blackman's book called Slavery by Another Name, which demonstrates how slavery really existed throughout much of the United States until World War II.
That book's about debt peonage and the way prisoners were really put into systems of slavery across the South in the late 19th century. Doug Blackman, by the way, is a writer for the Wall Street Journal who wrote one heck of a book about that story. So,
yeah. Right, yeah. So this book and also Rick Perlstein's recent book, Nixon Land, to me suggests a really interesting parallelism between the Reconstruction era and the 1970s. I wonder if you could just comment on if you see any similar, I don't know, parallels between the failure of Reconstruction and the turn in the 1970s after the Civil Rights Movement and the survival of white supremacy.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where you were going with that at first. I take your point. Obviously, we shouldn't be proud that white supremacy survived, but God did it ever. In fact, there seems to be no question. The philosophy of white supremacy became more virulent, even more highly organized, theoretically, philosophically, intellectually, in the late 19th century, was slavery gone than it had been. I mean, it was a different form by then. Actually, the books, and there's a libraries full of these. Actually, John David Smith, a good historian, did a collection, 800-page volume of white supremacist thought, you know, in the late 19th century. We used to say to John, you really want to devote your life to this topic? But good that he did, because there it all is in a volume. And there are lots of reasons for that. You know, in the absence of slavery and the emergence of Jim Crow and the fear of this rising, growing black population. And by the way, one of the most vicious arguments, one of the worst arguments, that's a silly way of putting it. They're all pretty bad arguments. But one of the most virulent arguments in the white supremacist thought of the late 19th century was that black people and other colored races were really going to die out. I mean, silly as it may seem today to young people, in this age of Spencerism and this misuse of Darwin and something called social Darwinism, in this world now believing in survival of the fittest and all that, racialized thinking took Darwin and Spencer and others and said, well, the weaker races really are going to die. Not just black people in America, but Filipinos and others, they're going to revert to barbarism. Frederick Douglass gave a whole speech about this in the late 1880s, about the power of this idea, this belief deeply embedded in Americans, white Americans largely, that black people were really going to die out. And so was the vanishing Indian, right? They were just going to die out. Well, the problem was white supremacists also read the census. By 1900, there were over 10 million black people. Damn, they more than doubled since the Civil War. What's up with that? You know, and 20% of them own property. What a bad idea, you know. So parallels between Reconstruction and the 1970s, of course. There are rich and interesting parallels. There are always cycles in history. Yes, Reconstruction failed in a host of ways, but it also had tremendous triumphs. It laid down a record. It laid down a history that, frankly, by comparison, South Africa didn't have. If you look at the history of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, those histories are very different in some ways. The history of apartheid in South Africa, the history of Jim Crow in America are richly comparative. George Fredrickson wrote a great book entitled White Supremacy, by the way, years ago on this, and went and learned Afrikaans to do it. I always thought that he deserved a Nobel Prize for that. But anyway, but South Africans, black South Africans, didn't have the 14th Amendment on the books in South Africa. They didn't have the 13th Amendment on the books. They didn't have the Bill of Rights. They didn't have the 15th Amendment. They didn't have a couple generations of jurisprudence that actually was on their side to a degree. So Reconstruction didn't totally fail. But when you look at the end of the Civil Rights Movement, you look at the rights phase of the Civil Rights Movement, the tremendous triumphs of the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts, the rewriting of the Constitution, second Reconstruction, and you look ahead into the 70s and all our struggles with busing And then again, the rising black middle, you've heard all this, the rising black middle class and yet the deepening black underclass and so on and so forth, we realize that we always take steps ahead. Maybe it's two steps ahead and one step back if we're lucky. Sometimes it seems like one step ahead and one step back. So I don't know where else you want to go with that story. And we also know, if we had our eyes open at all, that there was a big revival of white supremacist activity in the wake of Obama's election. The Southern Poverty Law Center did a huge report on this. You should pick it up and read it. They monitor the, you know, they're all small groups. I mean, the numbers, you just look at the numbers of white supremacy groups, you know, they're small percentages, but they can do awfully ugly things if they choose to. There's a big segment of this country that's not comfortable having a black president. We're not supposed to say that, though. I mean, we're supposed to be post-racial. And some of us are. A lot of young people are. I'm actually convinced that a lot of young people are. And we keep reminding them to be racial. Well, actually, we're reminding them to know their history. I mean, so that they don't get hit between the eyes. But they will.
Thank you again, Professor Blight. This concludes our event. Thank you for attending.